My guest this morning is Robert Fisk, and we taped this interview 2 weeks ago in San Francisco, where Robert has been making a victorious tour of California and the world with his new amazing book, The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East, now in its second printing in the United States, in its fifth printing in Great Britain, selling in France and all over the world. The Great War for Civilization. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks very much.
Delivering the goods. Now, this title sounds like something that comes out of a speech by current President George Bush, but I don't think he's going to like this book. What prompted it, and where does that title come from?
Well, my father was the genesis of this title. He was much older than my mother, and he was a soldier in the First World War. He went to the trenches of the Third Battle of the Somme in 1918 in France when he was 19 years old. And the war had a great effect on him. As a little boy, 10 years old, he used to take me back to the French villages, which were in ruins then, of course, where he used to sleep in the war and where his trenches ran sometimes right through the village streets. And from the age of 10, every year he'd go back to the battlefields of the First World War. And when he died, age 93, in 1992, I inherited his campaign medal for the First World War, British campaign medal. And on the back were engraved the words, "The Great War for Civilization." And I was already planning this book. I knew it would be a huge volume. And immediately I said to myself, this has got to be the title, because, of course, used ironically, because we know that the Great War for Civilization, the 1418 War, was not the war to end all wars. In fact, it gave birth to the borders of Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, most of the Middle East. The tragedy of the First World War is still with us today in the Middle East. So it seemed to me to be the only title one could use. But yes, I can see it emerging in a George Bush speech.
Well, there's a certain irony, because you have spent a great deal of your time within those borders tracing the effects of what happened in World War I and the intervention after Versailles of the British and the French in cutting up the region and actually short-stopping, as you've talked about, a plan that might have reversed the situation. Maybe you could talk about that.
Well, yes. I mean, you're quite right. I've spent my entire life as a journalist in Belfast and Belgrade and Bosnia and Beirut and Baghdad and what have you. All the borders which were drawn within 17 months of each other in the aftermath of my father's First World War, that's where I've worked, nowhere else but there. And, of course, I've watched the continuation of this tragedy. There was, yes, one bright moment in the aftermath of the First War when the Americans had this wonderful idea of creating a modern democratic Arab state, a huge one, stretching from the southern border of Turkey. Turkey, of course, wasn't an Arab country, from the eastern frontiers of Iraq, including all of Arabia, right across to the Atlantic coast of Morocco. The people who were behind it were primarily American diplomats in the Middle East, who, of course, were consuls to the dying Ottoman Empire, and people whom we would now call NGOs, but in fact were then missionaries for the Christian Church. And all these people petitioned the State Department saying, look, let's have a modern state with which we can have mature, grown-up relations instead of all these little tribal groups which were, you know, meshed together under the Ottoman Empire. And remember that the Ottoman Empire was the last time we actually saw Arab unity. The Ottoman Empire, for all its weaknesses, the sick man of Europe, we called it, of course, at the very end, did bind all Arabs together. You could get on your horse in Morocco, and one horse after another, you could go all the way to Constantinople or Istanbul today, or Beirut or Damascus, and you didn't need a passport or a document. It was all your country. The Ottoman Empire belonged to you. Of course, towards the end, the Arabs were, you know, brutally discriminated against, like other groups who weren't Turkish themselves. But nonetheless, it was a very intelligent idea in the aftermath of the First War to recreate the unity which the Arabs had lost, Ittihad in Arabic. Alas, President Woodrow Wilson fell ill and died. On the Hill, congressmen lost their enthusiasm for overseas adventures. There are other obligations, for example, to put American peacekeeping troops into a state called Armenia, much larger than the present rump state with its capital in Yerevan. The creation of a state protected by American troops called Kurdistan, which would have saved so many millions of lives and so much tragedy. America decided to turn away from that. It didn't even join the League of Nations, so it was unable to have any major effect to prevent the Second World War, and it went into this long period of isolationism from which it only really emerged in 1941, of course, in the day of infamy at Pearl Harbor.
Now, speaking of Armenia and Kurdistan, first with Armenia, you're the only journalist that I know that continues to talk about the Armenian genocide. And I think Hitler once made a comment, or supposed to have made a comment,
he did
who remembers the Armenians?
Yes, he not only made that to his generals in the Second World War, but he made it in a newspaper interview, almost exactly the same words, some years earlier. So he definitely did use that expression, yes, who now remembers the Armenians.
And it was very pressing on his part.
Well, of course, he was talking at the time about the Poles. But since such a large proportion of the Polish population at that period were Jews, because the Holocaust in Poland hadn't yet really begun, he obviously was referring to the Jews of Poland. And what links these two terrible events, the 1.5 million Armenians who were killed in the Armenian Holocaust or genocide, and the 6 million Jews who were killed by the Nazis in the Jewish Holocaust, is quite clear because, for example, the Turks, one of their methods of killing Armenian men in the Syrian desert, Syria now, then of course the Ottoman Empire, was to drive thousands of Armenians into caves in the desert, set fire to bonfires outside and blow the smoke inside so they were asphyxiated. The world's first gas chambers, you see. In southern Turkey, they moved thousands of Armenian men to pits and valleys where they would be massacred. In cattle wagons on the new German-installed railway lines, exactly in the same system used but in more modern form in the railway lines of Europe to send the Jews to Auschwitz and the other appalling extermination and concentration camps in Eastern Europe. And much more directly, some of the German junior officers who were training the Ottoman army at this period were witness to the driving out of Armenians and the massacres and the sending off of women and children into the deserts where they were stripped and raped, gang raped by the thousand. And some of the names of these German officers crop up again in Eastern Europe as Wehrmacht or SS officers during the Second World War participating in the Jewish Holocaust inside the occupied Soviet Union and the occupied countries of Eastern Europe. One of the witnesses of the Holocaust of the Armenians was a German diplomat who later became a right-hand advisor to Hitler and in fact was killed in the beer hall push by Hitler in Munich. He died right next to Hitler, in fact, and was buried with the usual Nazi honors. And he was a man who clearly influenced Hitler and must have talked to him at length about the ways in which the Turks were able to send the Syrian women and children off on the death marches into the desert and how they massacred the men, sometimes with knives, sometimes with rifles. The Turkish Ottoman authorities, in fact, found a very cheap way of killing Armenian men, not just by driving them into caves and asphyxiating them, but also by tying them together, sometimes with their families, throwing them in rivers, the Euphrates, the Habur River, for example, and shooting one in the head, and the body of that one, of course, would drag all the others beneath the water and they'd all drown. The fact that Turkey today still denies the genocide of the Armenians is one, I think, of the most shameful episodes, one of the continuing shameful episodes of the Middle East, especially at a time when Turkey wants to join the European Union. Imagine if the Germans said, oh, the Jewish Holocaust didn't happen, the Jews of Europe died in a civil war, which is the Turkish explanation for the Armenian genocide.
Well, in deference to the U.S. relation to Israel and Israel's relation to Turkey, the U.S. Congress has not recognized the Armenian genocide.
No, it wanted to, but President Clinton urged it not to on the grounds that it would endanger American lives in Turkey. Can you believe it? So fearful were the Americans of the Turkish threats that they simply prevented America's democratic representatives of acknowledging something that has been fully accepted in the past. I mean, Churchill actually called it a Holocaust in the 1920s, the Armenian genocide. It was the New York Times that broke the story of the Armenian genocide. Although for years recently, the New York Times always says the alleged Armenian genocide. They too have fallen back from their original high standards, not even wanting to acknowledge their own original scoop. Quite extraordinary.
Now, the situation of the Kurds is quite interesting because they're largely a mysterious group for people here in the United States. I mean, we have Kurds in five countries, I believe, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Iraq. and of course, Turkey, the villages were destroyed. And there was a possibility once of there being a Kurdistan.
No, under the League of Nations, there was to be a Kurdistan.
Yes.
And it would have been protected by American diplomatic and military forces. And indeed, in 1920, an American general actually visited Armenia and Kurdistan. He went through the ruins of Armenia, the dead cities, and of Kurdistan, and actually came back with a recommendation that it could be done, that Kurdistan could be set up, there would be a state for the Kurds, and that there would be the original Armenia, more or less, would come back into being, not the truncated version which eventually existed. In fact, the general went to see Armenian forces in the city of Kars, which after he left then fell to the Turks, and again the Armenians were massacred. So the Armenian genocide continued even after the Americans were given the mandate to run or to protect this new state, a mandate which they failed to take up.
Now, you speak with a passion, and you write with a passion that's very uncommon among journalists. And people say, well, journalists should be more distanced from their subject, should be more balanced, more even-handed. What's your response to that?
Well, I think I am very even-handed. I think that if you're compassionate and you have feelings, it means you are even-handed. If I see something which is an atrocity, I say so. And if I know who's done it, I say so in my newspaper. I write my reports like a letter to a friend. Would you believe what I saw today? If the ordinary person in the street, whether he be a bus driver or a baker or he works in a bank or whatever, sees a crime against humanity, he's outraged by it. He feels passion and anger. Well, we're allowed to feel anger too. We're allowed to feel passion. We're allowed to ally ourselves in our writing with the victims. This is a moral thing to do. The idea that you've got to give 50% of your story to one side and 50% of your report to the other is preposterous. If we were covering the slave trade, we wouldn't give equal time to the slave ship captain. If we were covering the liberation of an extermination camp, we wouldn't give equal time to the SS. We'd talk to the victims, the survivors. Similarly, when I was in Jerusalem in August of 2001, I was very close to a Palestinian suicide bombing of a pizzeria in which 22 Israelis were killed, more than half of them children. Well, I didn't give half of my report on this atrocity to the Hamas spokesman. When I was in the Sabra and Shatila camps in September of 82, when Israel's Lebanese Christian allies slaughtered 1,700 Palestinians, I didn't give half my story over to the Israeli Defense Forces spokesman. I gave my entire story to the victims and what happened. And I knew what happened. I saw the Israelis watching, and I saw some of the murderers leaving the camp in phalangist uniform.
Now, this passion, of course, is a character of your writings. It's ironic. One of the reasons for the success of your book is people in this country have been reading your writings on the internet. And yet you don't use email or the internet. It's kind of an irony.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
and I actually admire you not using email, because you could explain it.
Well, no, I mean, my view of the email system, I mean, it's a wonderful piece of technology. But apart from the fact that all the email letters received by my newspapers, at least not all but most, are ungrammatical, poorly spelt, rushed off in a hurry, often written by people who couldn't bring themselves to write a proper letter. They were too bored or too lazy to do it. And it's become a creator of work. It's become a creator of time misspent. I had a Boston Globe reporter sitting on my balcony in Beirut admonishing me for not using the internet. He said, by 12 o'clock midday, I've read the editorials in the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the London Times, the Independent, the Washington, the Jerusalem Post, the Daily Star in Beirut. I said, stop. I said, by midday, I've done three interviews and I'm writing a story for my newspaper. I don't care what the Washington Post says. Because this information is available, you're just sucking it in. Why? It's not necessary. I don't care what the New York Times says. I want to write, not read the New York Times. Thank you very much. And what happens is that once you're into the system, it seems to me, and I'm not, thank God, you're sucked into it totally, and you're locked in. Once you have email, the waves, the absolute tempest of mail and letters comes in at such a speed that you can't close it down and finish it, because there's always more to come. I get sometimes up to 250 real letters a week with stamps on and envelopes. That's enough, Jeffrey. That's enough. Thank you very much.
No, it's true. The information highway has become like a clogged parking lot.
No, there's another thing, and that is that the internet has also become a network of hate and a network of totally untrustworthy reports. To the extent that, for example, some of my reports are purloined and sent round in various websites, but bits of them have been changed or sections have been cut out, and I'm then asked to account for why I wrote this story in the way I did, when in fact I never wrote it like this. Endlessly I get, in my office gets, knowledge of websites attacking me in a most violent way. For example, after the actor John Malkovich said he wanted to shoot me, he made this statement at the Cambridge Union in Cambridge, England, a number of websites suddenly appeared saying that he was trying to jump the queue. One of them showed me being beaten to death with stones, something I could have lived without, because sometimes I go to places where people might want to beat me to death with stones.
Well, it nearly happened in Afghanistan.
It nearly happened in Afghanistan. It just needs one even more unstable person than Malkovich to pop up at a lecture I give in the United States, and I've got problems again. Especially because I insist on no security for lectures. People must be free to come. I'm not going to live under the shadow of 9/11. But no, I find the internet an extremely invasive, intrusive, and potentially very slanderous institution. And as I say, for emails, I simply don't have the time to waste on them.
Now, let's look at the situation in Iraq today. You have been one of the early critics, even before the war.
Long before the war.
Long before the war, and you were... You wrote, you predicted and said what was going to happen. Mm. So none of this, I guess, has surprised you. Actually worse than you may have
imagined.
There
was one surprise I had. I mean, I said before the war that there would be an insurgency, that the Americans would suffer for it, that the Iraqis would be the principal sufferers. And I said on the day that the American military pulled down the famous Saddam statue, not the Iraqi people, as people still claim, in Ferdows Square in Baghdad in April 2003. I wrote that night that the real story, the story of the resistance to the occupation of the Americans, will begin now. This is the real story. And I was really harassed by my colleagues for writing something like this. My only surprise was that the insurgency started so quickly and so violently. I thought we'd see the beginnings of it within 6 months, not 6 days. You know, within a couple of weeks, we had attacks on U.S. Marines, shooting at U.S. troops on the fringes of Baghdad. We had one incident, this is within 3 weeks of the famous liberation. We had one incident of a woman dressed in black trying to throw a hand grenade at a soldier who shot her. And lying wounded in the street, she tried to throw another hand grenade until she was shot dead. I would never have imagined that an insurgency resistance movement, call it what you like, would have sprung up with so fast and with such fire.
This resistance seems to be have different characteristics. You have some resistance that are concentrated on fighting the Americans, resisting the Americans.
Yeah.
You have other elements that are using suicide bombs, going attacking like Shia Moths, like happened the day we're making this interview, in which innocent civilians are targeted. Mm-hmm. And it would seem that there's some element of the Sunnis, and if you go on the internet, you'll think that it's the Mossad or the CIA.
Well, this is another problem with the internet, isn't it?
Yes,
I don't waste my time with it.
Yes.
I don't care what it says about Mossad. Look, the insurgency is principally being run by officers in the Iraqi army, which was disbanded by Paul Bremer and it's a rather foolish decision, to put it mildly, after the beginning of the American occupation. These are men who, as young officers, fought in this suicidally brutal Iran-Iraq war between 1980 and 88, a war which we in the West supported and encouraged Saddam to undertake, along with the Saudis and most of the Arab nations. And these men, now, of course, colonels or generals, are the backbone of the rebellion, insurgency, call it what you will. I know that because I met three of their leaders, including the commander from Fallujah, under a year ago, and the man walked into the room and said, "Ah, Mr. Robert, we meet again." And I said, "Hang on a minute, well, I don't remember meeting you before." He said, "Oh yes, you were on the front line opposite Basra at the beginning of the invasion of Iran, and I took the first tanks across the Karun River, the first Iraqi tanks, and you interviewed me on the first tank." And he was right, I did. So these are the men whom we, the West, now have to deal with. Al-Qaeda is something separate. The Al-Qaeda suicide attacks is a much smaller minority affair, even though it kills more people, especially Iraqis. And it is up, of course, to the leaders of the Iraqi insurgency to deal with al-Qaeda later. We can't do that. We can't fight al-Qaeda in Iraq. This is ridiculous. I mean, we went there to liberate them, allegedly. Then we went there to give them democracy, allegedly. We went there because of weapons of mass destruction, allegedly. We went there because of links between Saddam and 9/11, allegedly. And now we have to fight al-Qaeda? It's impossible to go on like this.
And that goes back to your book. This seems to be a replay of the British experience, almost word for word, back in the post-World War I period.
Yes, because, you know, General Angus Maud, the commander of the British forces, invaded Iraq in 1917. He arrived in Baghdad shortly before he died of cholera because he failed to boil his milk, and put up a poster on the streets of Baghdad, a poster which a young private in the Cheshire Regiment later tore off the wall and put in his knapsack because he thought it would be famous one day. A poster which I bought from his daughter just before the Anglo-American invasion in 2003 for $2,000. And it hung beside my desk as I wrote my book. And the proclamation, the poster, is a proclamation to the people of the Governorate of Baghdad, signed by Angus Maud, which begins with the immortal words, "We come here not as conquerors, but as liberators to free you from generations of tyranny." It could have said George W. Bush at the bottom instead of General Angus Maud, CNC, British Forces, Iraq. In 1920, an insurrection began against British forces. In the first major clash of that war, we, the British, laid siege to a city called Fallujah, which we partly destroyed. We surrounded a city called Najaf and demanded the surrender of a Shiite cleric, exactly what the Americans did in 2003-2004. British intelligence in Baghdad told the War Office in London that terrorists were crossing the Iraqi border from Syria, exactly what the Americans have been claiming for the last 12-13 months. And David Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, stood up in the House of Commons in London and said, "If British troops leave Iraq, there will be civil war," which is exactly what the British, what Mr. Blair, our own dear Prime Minister, and what President Bush have been saying for the last 12 months. It's an absolute fingerprint, parallel, identikit insurrection that happens today, except now it's on a much more ferocious and bigger scale.
Now, the morning we're speaking is the day after Congressman John Murtha, who is a Vietnam War veteran and has a lot of credibility because he supported this war, has now said the time is for immediate withdrawal, without conditions. And what was your response to when you saw Mr. Murtha's or Congressman Murtha's speech?
Well, the first response, Jeffrey, I have to admit,
yes,
is that if I could have known and looked into the future and had to choose the moment to publish my book in the United States, I'd choose today, and that's exactly what happened. I could never have imagined, since much of my book is about Iraq and is about the need to get out of Iraq, that it would actually come to the bookstores on the day that Congressman Murtha made this extraordinary statement. What he represents, I think, is a growing, I mean, from the 2 weeks I've spent in now, a growing reflection of genuine feeling on the part of Americans who feel totally cut off from the U.S. government. They feel in many cases that their own representatives whom they elected no longer represent them, because many of them still support a war, which is clearly, even despite the dumbing down of television and the emasculation of the newspaper reporting in the United States, is clearly a fiasco. It is a hell disaster, to use Churchill's phrase about Palestine. If you look at it politically and ask me that question, well, you know, it's the same old story I've written about in The Independent. The Americans must leave, the Americans will leave, and the Americans can't leave, which, as I always say, is the equation that turns sand into blood. It's very easy to go into a country and occupy it. It's very, very difficult to find a way out. Eventually, the Americans will have to talk to the Iraqi officers running the insurgency. Some of them were trained in America and Britain. They speak quite good English. They can be talked to, you know. But that's going to be, potentially, in present terms, a pretty humiliating experience. But, you know, that's what everyone says when they've fought a guerrilla warfare. They always say they won't talk to the terrorists. That's what the British said about the IRA, and they ended up talking to them. That's what the British said about Flossy in Yemen, and they ended up talking to them. It's what they said about Ayoka in Cyprus, and they ended up talking to them. It's what they said about Palestine, and they ended up talking to both sides to try and get out. It's what they said about Mau Mau in Kenya, and sure enough, they ended up talking to Kenyatta, and he got tea with the Queen. And it's what the Americans said about the North Vietnamese, and they ended up talking to them in Paris, courtesy of Dr. Kissinger. And inevitably, whether they be proxies or whether they be the actual insurrectionists, the Americans will end up talking directly to those behind the insurgency in Iraq in order to leave. And they will also need the help of Iran and Syria. So instead of attacking them and putting pressure on them, You will find that they'll have to soften their stance, the United States, if they want to get out. And the moment you see them taking a more mollified view towards the Syrian and Iranian regimes, which are not very pleasant, I grant you, then you'll know that plans are afoot to leave.
Now, there are those who propose that the United States withdraw but leave bases there. Do you think the possibility of there being a solution with U.S. bases remaining in Iraq?
I don't think that, with the exception of the Kurds, the Iraqis would tolerate this. It's gone far too far now. There's far too many dead Iraqis, far too many Iraqis killed by American firepower, far too much bitterness and suspicion and fury engendered among Iraqis to permit the Americans to, in a sense, continue an occupation without it being an occupation. That doesn't mean they can't talk. It doesn't mean the Americans can't leave with some dignity if that was properly arranged. As the French thought they were leaving Algeria with some dignity in 1962. But I think the idea that they will leave behind them these some vast bases from which ultimately they could always reemerge to try and reoccupy, you know, Tal Afar or Fallujah or Baghdad would be out of the question. I think these are going to turn out to be the biggest white horses in the Iraqi desert.
That brings in the role of Iran. There have been many people here who've been predicting as of for months that the U.S. was going to attack Iran. And of course, these are people who have never been over there, who don't really know who the players are. But what role is Iran playing in Iraq today?
Look, it's playing a major role because the two principal parties nurtured in Iran and faithful to Iran are the Dawa Party and Skiri, both of whom are in the government. It was the Dawa Party that arranged for the kidnapping of Westerners in Beirut in the 1980s because they wanted prisoners who were members of the Dawa Party freed in Kuwait, prisoners who were blamed, probably correctly so, for the Dawa bombing of the American embassy and the Dawa bombing of the French embassy and the Dawa bombing of the Emir of Kuwait's convoy in Kuwait. This is an organization that was characterized as one of the leading terrorist organizations of the world, as usual, by the State Department, but now, elected into power, it's one of the principal institutions in the new Iraqi government. The Americans talk directly to them, as they do to the Skiri, the Islamic Republic in Iraq party, and the Supreme Council of.
They fought actually with Iran against Iraq.
Absolutely,
in the war.
Absolutely. So these are people who are loyal to Iran, who were nurtured in Iran, who represent Iran in the government. So the whole idea that the Iranians have got some clandestine operation going in southern Iraq or are trying to interfere in Iraq is ridiculous. They're there. They are represented in the government, and they are a majority in the government, and the Americans talk to them. So the idea that we're going to invade Iran, especially when we're bogged down in Iraq, is preposterous.
And now it's interesting to you covered the Iran-Iraq war, and that's something that was kept in a distance here. I mean, Kissinger once said, "Let them keep fighting because they'll kill each other," in so many words. Mm-hmm. He did this in an op-ed piece in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. People have talked about the use of poison gas, and they debated back and forth whether Saddam used gas. You had some personal experience with that.
Absolutely. So have my other colleagues. I remember traveling back to Tehran one night on a hospital train from Ahwaz, a military hospital train, and finding hundreds and hundreds of Iranian troops crowded into the railway carriage compartments, all of them holding this handkerchief or gauze in front of their face, coughing up mucus and blood that had all been gassed by chemicals used by Saddam. This is long before Halabja and the gassing of the Kurds, at a time when the West would always refer to it as alleged use of gas by Saddam. When indeed we know, for example, after the retaking of the Fal Peninsula, that U.S. officers, serving officers, were observing the battlefield and noting coldly back to Washington that gas was being used and nothing was done about it. This was at a period when Donald Rumsfeld, the present Secretary of State for Defense, was visiting Baghdad and was asked and shaking hands with Saddam and was asking Saddam if the American embassy could be reopened. Rumsfeld later said he had remonstrated with Saddam about the use of gas, but it turns out that that was untrue. He then claimed he'd remonstrated with Tariq Aziz the following year. We don't know if that's true or not. But the fact of the matter is that gas was being used on a vast scale, and we totally ignored it because we were quite happy for the Iranians to be gassed. We wanted Saddam to win the war and overthrow the Islamic Republic of Ayatollah Khomeini. My colleagues in the press, for example, Mohammed Salam of the Associated Press, he was working for AP, but he's a Lebanese journalist. He was one of the first reporters to witness the results of gas warfare. He went down to a battlefield near Basra, with a reporter from the Yugoslav news agency, Tanjug. And he saw thousands of dead Iranian troops, many of them just sitting in their trenches or their foxholes, dead. He said he stopped counting at 1,000. They had all urinated in their trousers and they all had blood around their noses. They'd breathed in a mixture of nerve gas and chemicals, which first of all knocked out their nervous system and then effectively drowned them in their own lungs. And they're all sitting there in their foxholes, sometimes with their eyes open and their little packages on their back, where they always carried their food and a package on their back, the Iranian troops. And Mohammed came back and couldn't understand what it was. And then found he himself was suffering from some sickness and had to be evacuated to Cyprus because he had breathed in some of the gas in these holes in the ground. I later came across Iraqi soldiers after the American occupation of Iraq who talked to me about how they had seen their own men using gas. And one man, he was actually a florist who sold me trees to put on my balcony in my room in Baghdad. And he told me that he was at Halabja. He said, "I saw the beans on the trees grow black and the birds dropping from the sky." And he said, "We saw people, whole families in clusters, holding each other dead in the fields together." He said, I said, what did you say? He said, "We said nothing. We were too frightened. We were just silent."
You've been to Iraq and Iran. You were in Algeria doing a really violent...
A very Iraq-like war in which foreigners had their throats cut. Algerians, yes. Whole villages had their throats cut. Another Islamist government war in which the government, just like in Iraq, used death squads and murdered people, civilians as well. Appalling war, but not as bad or as dangerous as the Iraq war, certainly not for journalists as bad, almost as bad there.
And you put this book together. What was it like to do that?
It was a deeply depressing experience. When I got to sort of page 200, I told a very sort of almost funny story of how a colleague of mine, John Snow, of ITV and myself had helped to rescue, he was principally the rescuer, the crew of a British ship trapped in the Shatt al-Arab River being fired at with missiles and rockets and artillery by both the Iranians and Iraqis. And we got them ashore, and my mournful job, most of the crew actually was Sri Lankan or Indian, and I had to take all their duty-free goods off them, colored TV sets and fridges, and chuck it back in the river because we had to take them across this island under fire. There wasn't going to be any time to take their duty-free goods with them. And eventually I got John's film to Amman, and we fed it by satellite to London, and it went to New York, a beautiful story of, you know, the Englishman rescuing the British crew, complete with the British captain's newlywed wife. And the next morning, because John had swum the Shatt al-Arab and I'd sat on the shore pulling the rope to bring the lifeboat over with the crew in, my foreign editor sent me a telex which was pushed under my door of my Amman hotel, which said, "Fisk, why you no swam shark-infested Shatt al-Arab River?" But I went and told a very dear friend of mine after I wrote that. I read this passage to her and I said, there's nothing else happy in the book. The rest of the book is torture, betrayal, injustice, death, war, ethnic cleansing, genocide. And she said, that is the end of the sweet stories. So in fact, I began the next paragraph with her words, "That is the end of the sweet stories." And the rest of the book was a deeply distressing book to write, a very unhappy book. I never want to write it again. I remember one afternoon I was really depressed and I'd just been writing about nothing but torture, the torture of women, the torture of young men, the execution of people in Iraqi dungeons and Iranian prisons and the mass hanging of women and men. And my young French researcher came downstairs to my library and said, "Robert, we're going to go for a walk on the beach. We've got to get you out of here. We're going to have a beer together. You've got to get away from it." And I mean, I began to realize when I was writing the book that what I thought was the privilege of witnessing history was in fact a curse. And the book is the story of that curse.